My name is Glenn Garrismill, National Coordinator of Lutheran Peace Fellowship, and the title of the session is something on the order of Lutheran Peace Fellowship, an opportunity to work for peace and justice in the United States and the world. And I thought we could respond to a question that I've heard more often than not. It's one of the more common questions that I get. People say, blessed are the peacemakers, but like, what does that mean, like, concretely or practically? How can we understand that in as more than a platitude? And why don't we start, or do you have comments on that? What would you say if a member of your congregation said after a sermon in which that phrase occurred, or as part of a song or something? I've heard that before, and it makes sense, but concretely, practically, what do we mean by blessed are the peacemakers? What does it mean to be a Christian peacemaker? Yeah.
Only God will bless them because nobody else will.
Okay.
Sorry.
Tap your wit and...
sometimes we sing about gentle Jesus, but I see Jesus as more of a radical, overturning, in Borg's words, I think, the conventional wisdom. And I remember something that I saw in a South American country, and it was over the street as a bridge near a boys' school, and it said, We educate for peace. Without justice, there is no peace. So I think justice is really basic.
Other thoughts? What would you say? Concretely, what does it mean to be a peacemaker?
Well, I think that it's a strong word. I think that we've kind of given peace a weak sense. And I guess I think of peace as a strong word because it's more than just the absence of conflict. It's conflict resolution, as I see it. So there's a sense of making peace is not having it be nice and soft and cushy and everybody be happy, but it's more an attitude towards tolerance, towards allowing people to be whole and human. Those are the kinds of things I think of. And when I think of the phrase, blessed are the peacemakers, I think of the context that, at least in the Bible, as I understand it, when something is blessed, that there's an emphasis placed on that. So that's something that we, that in terms of our own help, ought to be, if you use the word ought, I guess maybe you ought not to, but that sense of that peace is an important thing to pay attention to.
Right. Right.
When I think of peacemaker, Glenn, I'm reminded of our youngest daughter came home one day, and she is a friendship with four other girls, and there was a conflict going on within that friendship, and she didn't really understand the position of either side, and she didn't feel like she could take either side, and she said, Mom, I don't exactly know what to do in this relationship. And I said, so we kind of talked about what it's like to be a peacemaker, and as Bruce suggested, we talk a lot about problem solving. And I said to her, well, maybe you can be the peacemaker in the relationship, because you clearly, don't see the issues as the other girls do. Maybe you can be the bridge of friendship and go back in there and figure out if you can help them talk to each other and kind of let yourself be that. He said, it takes a lot of courage. But if you really are grieving for what's happened here and you don't want this, maybe you can do that role. And she did. I don't know what happened, but I asked her the next day, how did it go? And she said, we're all talking, Mom. We got back in and tried it. So I think the problem solving and knowing that you can get back in and talk through it was really an important piece for her to understand.
Boy, wouldn't our lives have been different if somebody had told us that at that age or younger?
Huh? Yes.
I feel like I was such a late bloomer on a lot of these things myself.
The practical things too, I tend to think of the two extremes, really, the leaders in peace movements and then just the mundane everyday things. I mean, that's a level I confronted most often. And it's the level right and there's some value in that, and also as money, what you do with your money, where it goes, what kind of groups can support, but down to what mutual funds to pick that are screened for social issues and things.
Any other answers to the question? Well, I thought I would do three things. One is to share a little bit about the vision of LPF, and two, to share a little bit about some of the activities around the country and the world that LPFers are involved in, and then three, talk a little bit about some of the resources that LPF brings to that task. The pink sheet, if anyone didn't get it, I'll hand you one. You might want to grab each of those three there. Gives our vision statement that we've agreed on as a board in the Lincoln Peace Fellowship. It was used in the newsletter for some time before then. And I've written on the board four of the four kind of points of that statement. Within Peace Fellowship, it comes right in the middle of the page, right below the box with the quote in it, is an independent group of Christian peacemakers who seek peace according to the biblical vision of shalom. And that first, so the first point is it's Christian, it's biblically grounded, worship-centered peacemaking. And one of the really stunning realities that, you know, like you, I've heard or read the Sermon on the Mount many, many times over the years, and it, you know, the points where you really open your heart and mind to it, it's a shocking document for being the most popular sermon in the world, and it's transparent that you can't achieve what is being laid at your feet, what you are being challenged to do, without that rebirth, that renewal, that strength that comes from prayer, from worship, from the support of a community of peacemakers that working on this. And in that same sentence, the definition of peacemaking comes from the biblical definition of shalom, which in its roots means peace with justice. They're really not separable. There is many times where the predicate of the commandment after loving God is to bring justice, to uphold the weak, feed the hungry, support the outcast, visit the prisoner, as well as bridging a gap between combative parties and other more typical peacemaking activities. And a number of our projects are really as much on the justice side as the peace side because of that, as we'll see in a bit. The third clause, affirm nonviolence as the means of obtaining justice and reconciliation. A commitment to nonviolence. And not nonviolence in the kind of common definition of the term as not violence. There's a kind of a very weak, like absence of violence or even passivism as with the double S that I think is in the minds of a lot of people about the term. What we mean is what Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Dorothy Day and Jesus Christ meant by that is active. Active nonviolence would be probably the best definition of Gandhi's far superior term, satyagraha, which the roots of which meant truth force, that clinging to and seeking what is true in a situation and a total commitment to that on the one hand, and then a power that springs from that. The stunning examples that you saw in the Gandhi film or that you've encountered in readings about Gandhi. One, a classic, and it's brief enough to share maybe here, that a moment when one of the political opponents of some of the people that Gandhi was hanging around with at the time rushed up to Gandhi, grabbed him around the throat, and began choking him to death. And Gandhi's internal stability and security and power was able to overwhelm the anger and the conviction and the whatever of his assailant before he lost, you know, consciousness. And the man fell to his feet in tears and became one of his disciples. I'll tell another even more favorite story of Gandhi a little later. And then finally, active, if the active wasn't clear there, it's certainly clear in the verb building alternatives to not simply be in favor of peace. I have to say that at various points in my life, the most exasperating single groups of people were not the people that wanted war or that supported a military buildup, but those whose be-all and end-all, the response to the challenges of the day was simply to think differently. And as important as that is, there's something terribly disempowered and frustrating about the penchant of whole sectors of our society, who I feel have been actively disempowered by a structure that finds it more convenient to have people disenfranchised or disengaged from the political process. You know, a lack of democracy seems to be more convenient to a lot of places in our society. And in contrast, to have a commitment to build these alternatives. And I guess if to those four, I would add three other points. One is probably obvious from the conversation we've had so far, and that is an understanding of structural violence. That violence is not simply individual mugging individual B, or country A going to war with country B, but as Don Helder Camara so eloquently described, the different kinds of violence, the violence of a system to the poor that are disenfranchised in that system, is as important as the counter-violence that a police force may bring come down on the heads of those when they attempt to do something about it. And then two qualities that I like above all, perhaps, or as much as anything in LPF and in other effective groups. One, a very practical sense. A lot of people that have taken these four points to mean becoming skilled to continually learning the skills of peacemaking, of research, of strategizing, of shaping issues so that they can be as effective as possible to one's constituency, the skills of worship as well, of not being sloppy about anything that you do. And then secondly, or finally, a kind of a creativity, fearlessness, flexibility, a non-rigid kind of peacemaking that has as much humility as self-confidence. It's something that I admire about LPF, and it's great to be around, and is very sustaining for me. Well, I looked back over a couple issues of the newsletter and jotted down a few examples that can maybe extend the initial discussion that we had of what does it mean practically to be a peacemaker from different parts of the country, and I thought I would share them as a way of moving a step forward here. Wisconsin La Crosse is our newest chapter of LPF, so starting groups that are explicitly connected with LPF and that get bundles of newsletters when we mail them and communicate regularly, put out little newsletters, put on events and so forth. There are chapters in half the states in the country at this point in one or another level of development. Denver, the Synod Board of Church and Society contributed money to one of our projects, the curriculum project, and for LPFers to both be leaders in those kind of spheres, but also see connections between the two and ways that one can support another. Washington State, a group of Lutheran Peace Fellowship members, have been trained in peer mediation and conflict resolution, have worked in schools in the entire county, and brought it as well to the Sunday school and did as intensive a training program in the Sunday school for young people to learn those skills. Perhaps my favorite protest of the spring and summer was the Lent and Holy Week march in the Carolinas. An interfaith group marched from Fort Bragg, the largest military presence in the states, to Raleigh, the capital politically of the state, and circled at the end the Capitol building, and then walked the three blocks to Senator Helms' office. He's the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm sorry, Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, Foreign Relations Committee. I'll just share one note that is, occasionally there are visual, symbolic images that in their odd ways clarify or represent what's awry in our world. And one of the most dramatic for me of the last few months was to learn that there are four buildings in a row on the base of Fort Bragg. Three are churches, I believe it's Lutheran, Baptist, and Catholic, and the fourth is the John F. Kennedy Center for Counterinsurgency Warfare. And they did Stations of the Cross in front of all four. And it's a very rich kind of visual or geographic image to think of the ways in which the church has periodically blessed such activities, or the ways in which militarism seeks to find justification or from religious rhetoric. The number of times that people have gone to war in the name of religious belief. There's a stereotype that often is a close cousin to racism crazed Islamic militants being willing to die for their cause, and yet far more people have died under the banner of the cross in military endeavors over the centuries than any other single banner, or perhaps all other banners put together. Just a reminder there. Illinois, a group of LPFers vigiled and protested and were on several of the largest television stations protesting the death sentence executed on against a person on death row, for whom scholars at Northwestern University Law School had obtained substantial evidence that the person wasn't guilty, that was disregarded at the end. Minneapolis, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Wisconsin, Synod resolutions were passed, drafted by LPF on a number of issues, declaring August 6th, the Hiroshima Day, a day of prayer for peace. It falls on a Sunday this year, and on hunger and militarism, and on the arms trade. There are copies of the congregational versions of those resolutions. Congregations are now going to take them up around the country, and our whole membership got copies of the revised version of that. Albuquerque was one of three churches. There were three churches in three different parts of the country that are supporting a community, and by that I mean a number of villages and rural areas in El Salvador that are being left out of the reconstruction funds because they were on the wrong side of the guerrilla war over the last decade and a half, and helping them repair a roof on a school, build a bridge after two children had fallen to their deaths from the bridge, one of these hanging rope type bridges, and with just the to our minds, insignificant amount of money, we're able to construct a safe way of crossing that way, the only way to the market for some of the towns. And then, of course, countless educational activities in at least 24 states that I know of. Series on Bonhoeffer, for example, in New York, Washington, D.C., Wisconsin, Washington State, GME workshops in Ohio, Iowa, and Colorado coming up. There'll be more than 24 LPF workshops in all of those. At the churchwide assembly and festival, speaking tours that are set up for LPF members to go around. We'll probably top 100 workshops this year by the end of the summer, at least, perhaps 120. And finally, and perhaps as exciting as anything, leadership by LPFers of groups of people going to or projects that are directly connected with and involve people going back and forth to Bolivia, South Africa, Guatemala, South Korea, El Salvador, Poland, Japan, Haiti, and the Middle East in just the last 6 months. I should add Bosnia to that. And I think we all have benefited. I mean, you think back, you know, your own development as a peacemaker, the invaluable contribution of either people that have worked in or come from the two-thirds world, the areas of conflict around the world. So that's an attempt to give a little bit of a flavor to what LPF is doing around the country. Are there either questions that you have about LPF at the grassroots or comments of activities that you've heard of that you'd like to share? Again, in answer to the question, what does it mean concretely to be a peacemaker and a justice seeker in today's world?
Just something to clarify. You use the terms biblically and Christian almost interchangeably. Do you mean to do that?
Well, I probably won't anymore. what would be the reason why I won't be doing that anymore?
Well, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of Jewish people who would never be good Christian peacemakers. And biblically, that's a good overall term.
Uh-huh.
But it's not always a Christian term. I just wondered.
Uh-huh. No, I appreciate you saying that. My sister has gotten me to say the First Testament rather than the Old Testament on the same grounds. Yeah. And if I say the other one, I try to remember to like, well, wait a second, I'm still learning on this one. Okay, thank you. I think biblically grounded and Christian can both be terms, but they're not identical, and that's
and that's a wonderful term.
Mm-hmm.
When you use them both together, side by side.
Yeah, maybe with an and between them or something. Yeah. Okay. Other thoughts here?
Are there any significant differences between Lutheran Peace Fellowship and, for instance, what we call the Quakers, or some of the, I think, the newsletters that I get at work are from a Catholic Peace Fellowship.
Well, the historic peace churches, Quakers and Mennonites and Brethren, are rising in the visibility of the mainline churches and the Catholic Church in the important both witness that they have maintained over the years and experience that they have to offer. I think it's incalculable the contribution they've made and the lessons that we have to learn from them. I'll say that first off. There was a conference just last week at the University of Notre Dame where leaders, theologians, church leaders from most of the mainline denominations in the Catholic Church met with John Howard Yoder and other representatives of the historic peace churches to basically learn from that experience. And it was a high-level consultation, the Faith and Order in the Catholic Church convened, but invited representatives from other congregations. One of their readings was this new book, love your enemies, discipleship, pacifism, and just war theory. I'll also comment that there are about at least a dozen, in fact a good bit larger than it, close to 20 peace fellowships in the world. Catholic, Baptist, Buddhist, Methodist, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Episcopal, several other non-Christian groups, Jain, for example, peace fellowships, the word plus the peace fellowship. And there's a kind of a coordination that goes on with one of the offices in the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is the oldest of the peace fellowships, 80 years old, and 75 years old internationally and nationally this year. And in turn, there's a fair amount of meeting at least once a year and cooperation and sharing of newsletters and so forth. And in turn, connected with the secular peace organizations. I've worked for Peace Action and worked closely with a lot of other groups. I've consulted with Federation of American Scientists, done talks for or spoken at conferences of probably another 30 of the major peace groups. And I think there's a lot to learn. And and at the same time, while I think we need to seek ways of being more effective, I don't share the notion that we ought to all get together in one group. I think there's a way that we can talk to Lutherans that Peace Action or the Physicians for Social Responsibility can't, while at the same time we need to cooperate. And several of the projects, like the Curriculum Project or the Arms Trade Project, you'll notice all of those organizations and the United Nations Association and the League of Women Voters and other groups, working together to be more effective. That group, for example, I joined a delegation visit to meet with our Senator Patty Murray just the day before I left to come up here. So a couple days before.
I just have a question about the youth violence piece. It's a piece that, at least in my mind, I would think of the Lutheran Peace Fellowship primarily as looking at global
right.
peace and justice issues, and it's one that's much more right on our doorstep. And what's been the response of the curriculum, and what about working with other agencies, GAIN task force, and those kinds of things that have been involved in that?
Mm-hmm. Anybody not pick up one of these coming in? Yeah. You have one of these?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's look at that first. It's in the second column under Community and Youth. LPF has long seen the value of working on the different levels, and I, for myself, think of four: international, intergroup, which is like ethnic conflicts, thirdly, community, and fourthly, interpersonal. And there's a real value to working on and gaining from the insights on one that can be applied to another. As you function. And there'll be more or less emphasis on one or another, just depending in large part on what's happening in the world. It's indisputable that the place where there's the most interest, I mean, the most calls that I've gotten over the last 2.5 years for talks and for, workshops and so forth, has been on that third level of community violence, or what's happening with young people, the curriculum. I mean, I personally have probably given 70 talks on that in the last 2 years, just alone. And I think it's really important to respond to those levels of interest in the world. And at the same time, they can be places to help people make the connections with the other levels. The lessons really do transfer from one area to another. The curriculum, in fact, one of its distinctive qualities compared to the 70 or so other curricula that we've read and heard about and looked at in the construction of ours, what is one of the things that's distinctive that is shared by only two or three others of the ones that we've seen is that it does look at all four of those levels. The explosion of interest in community violence has resulted in a lot of these shake-and-bake curricula, you know, profit-making curricular publishing company. So we got to fill this niche, and pulls together people, you know, reads a bunch of books, and cranks out something in 6 months to meet the market. And they're actually better than I feared, by and large. A lot of them have made use of Getting to Yes and some of the other classics and conflict resolution. The problem in the actual implementation of those programs, as someone who spent, you know, 5 years teaching in curriculum development in the middle and high school levels, is that frequently those conflict resolution programs are sort of squeezed into the margins of the curriculum, right after age education and right before they go into like driver ed or something, and it's frequently not a kind of a center, a leader, recognized person in the school, but someone who is either imported in for a short while, or it's an add-on onto the teacher that has the lowest course load at the time. You know, the PE teacher takes it over. Kind of stereotype comes to mind from my own high school education, where ours captures the. Having started out as a language arts teacher, probably the most effective and most certainly most popular or influential movement in the language arts in the last decade goes by various titles, including reading across the curriculum. The idea of mobilizing the talents and input and involvement of the best teachers in the school in every curriculum area to help teach language arts. It's too important for kids to learn reading to leave it to one teacher in one period a day. And that same concept is true about conflict resolution. Our approach has been, in contrast to decades of efforts to get peace studies imposed by state legislators or school districts, our approach has been to go to teachers' conferences or network our way into schools, finding the best teachers that are there, the teachers that the kids admire and respect the most, and talk about how materials that we've produced or these other curricula can be used more effectively in their classes, and then infused and spread out into other pieces of the curriculum. These are often the teachers that are the most likely to do collaborative work with teachers in other areas. A lot of the work that we've done is in experiments like that. We've worked with a couple dozen classrooms and a number of youth groups. We're in a third major revision of the curriculum. We've probably talked to an equal number or a greater number of parents groups and teachers groups. The media has been very interested in it. We've had articles published in all kinds of magazines and newspapers and newsletters about it, and have felt like that's part of the idea. It's not so much we're selling our curriculum as encouraging schools and parents to understand that it's possible to do something more effective than the kind of add-on stereotype that I described earlier. And it's been a very exciting experience to ourselves in the process learn more about the way in which peacemaking occurs on all those levels, the international and the community, the intergroup and the interpersonal.
Are there any attempts at working in such a way that some of these materials can access kids who aren't in school, which seems to be a significant piece of the problem?
Yeah. We made a decision early on to not focus specifically or exclusively on the so-called at-risk population. Partly, our experience was more in either mainstream classrooms or in like inner-city classrooms, but to support the learning of the kids that weren't already in the gang, so to speak. And I think there was appropriate humility about. The people that I know that are working with gangs, there's a learning curve that, you know, maybe at some point we'll be able to access, you know, or incorporate some of those other materials into the curriculum. So the basic answer is our conception of the problem is that it is not simply trying to get those kids to behave better, the at-risk, you know, kids, but rather to create a whole different climate in the school, to create a whole different conception in our society of how you deal with conflict, which involves, I think, is necessarily will involve a revolution in the way this society deals with media, for example. Again, I mean, I mentioned one of the defects of that add-on curriculum. Another one of the really catastrophic defects of it is that you can often see in just oozing out of the curricular materials themselves this the impulse by perhaps otherwise well-meaning school board members and worried parents and community members that what they want out of this curriculum is to get those kids to behave, to not mug me on the street. Well, having been mugged a number of times myself, I can sympathize with that impulse, but it's probably not the either the most direct or the most successful route to changing the problem, to try to impose a different set of behavior on kids that are troubled. And in fact, a lot of that trouble is a reflection of some other larger things in this society that, in our view, have to be addressed. It won't work to simply have workshops for the kids that seem most likely to mug other people, as valid and as important as that task is. Well, as just the three other issues on this page illustrate, we're operating on some other levels. I mentioned this year Hiroshima Day falls on a Sunday, and it's a tremendous opportunity for our church, our congregations, and our culture to take a look at how we view the past and how that influences the present and the future. And we've wrestled with this a lot. There are those in even in Lutheran Peace Fellowship, but certainly in the peace movement, that would like nothing more than to take sides on the issue of should we have dropped the bomb, or to criticize the historical moment, the decision to drop the bomb. And you know, it's a huge debate. One of the interesting things about the debate, and I have a sheet, I think it's out here, yeah. If you're interested, it's called Hiroshima Rewritten, and one of the scholars of the movement quotes from four top military leaders of the war who disagreed with the decision to drop the bomb. And one of his points is, these are four testimonies, these are four points of view that never even made it into the first or the final draft of the Smithsonian exhibit. They had already excised and edited out and left on the cutting room floor Dwight Eisenhower and the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the chief of staff of the Army and the speechwriter for, and himself a general, of MacArthur, not to mention MacArthur himself. Their point of view opposing the dropping of the bomb, let alone Leo Szilard and a number of the other of the highest ranking scientists in the project. So that's a valid discussion to be involved. And I think there will be some congregations that will show films or have discussions that can get into those. Our goal was more modest, perhaps, but was also more bringing people together to say, soldiers and peace activists alike don't like war, know that war is a horror, and that it is possible, no matter what your point of view is on that particular historical incident, to acknowledge that it was both a horrible weapon, it was used almost entirely against civilians, and secondly, that it ought to bring us to our knees in a human kind of a sense. It ought to support our efforts to make it possible to never use those again. And you know, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, military people and civilians and peace activists alike, I think can share that impulse and can find that in the moment of the beginning of the atomic age in warfare, the moment when it actually entered the experience of war. So I'm actually interested in reactions on that and ways that we can effectively do that. I'll be getting calls from all kinds of congregations and some already. I mean, a whole synod is mailing out the materials that we used in Pennsylvania, for example, and there are half a dozen other synods that are looking to do so. Every synod office has the material already that was mailed a couple weeks ago. And so I'm eager to learn from my experience here and from your input on how to really make that work and to either deal with or effectively sidestep some of the ways in which people feel in different camps about the issue, to be able to come together to be peacemakers in the future.
Maybe you could help us, Glenn, just out of your own experience. How do you respond when you go, say, to a congregation where there are lots of World War II veterans and people who feel strongly that it was the right thing to do? How do you respond when you hear that? Or maybe you don't hear that, but
I do.
Assume that you do.
I have, yes. The last congregation that I spoke at, the adult forum, I would say a third of the participants were veterans, and it was within 10 minutes of a large naval base in Washington State. I mean, I begin with humility and with the acknowledgement. I try to use anything that I have available. I mean, I'll say, I didn't serve in the military, but I've both studied with and worked with military people in my professional life, and married to the daughter of a Navy veteran who lost a leg on an aircraft carrier, and so forth. I mean, to try to sort of position myself as accessible to that perspective, as at least somewhat knowledgeable of what it's like, and then to upfront acknowledge there is a legitimate debate about whether the atomic bomb ought to be used. There are well-meaning, Christian, ethically motivated and driven people on both sides of that question. I think it's unfortunate that discussion hasn't been able to be engaged in the public arena. I mean, I think there has been problems on both sides about how it's been posed, but to say that it would be arrogant to say that I know the answer one way or another. I won't claim that, you know. And to say that it's a historic fact, or at least in a heavily documented interpretation, that the civilian leaders have more often pulled us into war than military leaders. Military officers who have served in combat are often more reluctant than their civilian counterparts to bring us into war. That's just historically documentable. The folks that I've worked with and served with who come out of the military I'm proud to call them friends. I mean, they're admirable people. We may disagree on one or another issue, but I'm persuaded that many, many people in the military are as committed to peacemaking as I am. So, I mean, I think there are some things that you can say that are true and that are useful in helping to build that connection. And at the same time, I mean, I will later on in the discussion, if it moves in that direction, talk about how there's a double standard, for example. If 100,000 people lose their lives in a military operation to do some to save a people that are threatened or to defend a particular area, that seems reasonable. But when 50 people die in a peacekeeping operation, the pressures are insurmountable to pull out. well, there's something a little out of balance here. That people say that when there are deaths in peacekeeping, that somehow that proves that it's not workable. Well, you know, there are times when I think that 50 million people dying in World War II might suggest that, maybe military action isn't entirely workable. And I'll get a laugh out of that, because it's true. We don't think that way. There's something that has really predisposed us to look at those two things with a different standard, a different yardstick.
Are there things in the structure of the United Nations, the boundaries about what peacekeepers can do, that should be changed to make it more effective?
One of the lessons that everybody I know in the UN feels we need to learn from the Bosnia situation or the Somali situation is that the UN definition of peacekeeping was a lot smarter than we've implemented it. That is, you cannot commingle peacemaking and peacekeeping. Historically, peacekeeping was only, you would only go into a country with UN peacekeeping forces if there was a treaty agreed on by both sides, and both sides, former combatants, invited, were a part of inviting the UN into the situation. Peacemaking may be a role to be expanded within the UN. There is not a consensus about that yet. There's a big debates about that, and I think there needs to be some experimentation and humility about that task. But when you try to take a peacekeeping operation and interject a peacemaking effort, like going after Idid, was a very, very questionable strategy or tactic. It not only didn't work very well, but it left all the peacekeepers vulnerable. So there would be one example of a debate that's happening within the UN and within the UN reform movement to try to rethink, the experience of Bosnia and Somalia and come up with something. I'll say a final word about international peacekeeping. And I'll pick of the two on this page, the nuclear issues and the arms trade, the international arms trade as an example of an issue that LPF has been involved in for some time, more than a year, and is shaping up to be one of the most important and most potentially positive and successful efforts that we could be involved in. As you may know, the United States now sells vastly more military equipment and training services and supplies to the developing world or the two-thirds world than not only any other nation, but every other nation, like twice as much as every other nation put together. That was not always true. And in fact, during the Cold War, we would ask, what are we doing supplying arms to the Shah of Iran, who was, by everybody's definition, a terrible human rights abuser, was using the arms as much to oppress his own people than to deal with any external threat, etc. And we'd ask the same thing about Noriega and Marcos and so forth, despots around the world. And we were always told, they're not great folks. We acknowledge that, but their regional rival is armed by the Soviet Union, or is the Soviet Union, and we've got to help them out. And that was the end of the discussion, and the arms flowed. Well, the end of the Cold War comes, and lo and behold, not only did we not end or reduce significantly the sale of arms to third world totalitarian or authoritarian countries, it's expanded. In both dollar terms, it's two or three times, four or five times as much as any Cold War year, and that's in constant dollars, not leaving inflation out. We've also expanded the number of countries from the 40 or 50 or 60 countries during the Cold War to 140 countries or more in each of the last 3 years. So that where it used to be considerably less than half of all of that smaller amount of arms went to unstable, human rights abusing, undemocratic countries, now it's 85 or 90% of all of the arms being sold. And it doesn't make sense, as well as it stretches your moral credulity past the breaking point.
Whose logic is being used?
The simplest way of answering that is to cite the oft-quoted little sign at the doorway above the light switch in the Clinton campaign office. It's the economy, stupid. Ron Brown is more important and more central to the increase in arms sales than Perry, the Secretary of Commerce, is more important than the Secretary of Defense to that effort. And the irony is, as the article from the business section of the New York Times and on the flip side the Wall Street Journal illustrate in detail, the economics are not only weak, but there's a very strong argument can be made that we're not making anything off of it. For every dollar we get to a U.S. defense worker, we're giving away an equal amount or more to sell the technology to these other countries, selling the arms with the left hand and loaning the money to the country with the right hand, subsidizing it to the tune of $7 or $8 billion a year, and getting involved in a kind of a technical but very important business transaction called offsets, where you have a $2 billion deal to Finland or Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. That looks like, if you read our local newspaper, it looks like that'll be $2 billion in U.S. worker pockets, and it's a very difficult thing to oppose politically. But in fact, another $1.5 or $2 billion worth of benefits flow to that country that will rob U.S. workers of an equivalent number of jobs. And the actual economic benefits are virtually, you know, nothing. That's important because I don't think our track record is very good on winning on purely moral issues. I mean, you can do it, but the reality is that we can find allies among those who can agree with us on the pure practical self-interest level that this is not smart. There's a bill in Congress called the Arms Trade Code of Conduct Bill that would end arms sales to countries that are either undemocratic, bad on human rights by the State Department's definition, that use the arms to attack their own people or neighboring countries, or that don't participate in UN efforts to begin to control the arms trade, any of those four. And it's a well-written and very brief bill, 10 pages is a record, I think, that allows the Congress and the President to overturn that if necessary, in their opinion. But what it would do would be to put the debate on the table for, you know, people listening into C-SPAN and the newspaper editors and editorialists to engage that discussion in a way that it simply doesn't happen now. Congress does not vote on any of this stuff unless it chooses to. And while it has a role in the process, in the 20 years since the Arms Export Control Act and the Foreign Assistance Act were passed in the mid-70s, not a single arms deal has ever been stopped by Congress. I mean, none of the sale of arms to Iraq up into the week before the invasion of Kuwait, or the giving of funds that allowed them to, you know, deal with, you know, feeding their people with those funds so they could free up other funds to buy arms, which is virtually the same thing. None of those things have ever been successfully, you know, stopped. And the restrictions on, for example, we can't sell arms to countries that are evidently building nuclear weapons, like Pakistan was for years, and still is. I mean, has nuclear weapons, were never applied. I mean, they were circumvented and lied about. It's an important issue. It's a clear one in terms of morality. I think people grasp the idea of this flood of weapons out into the world not being a good thing. We've matched up the Pentagon list of potential conflict points in the world with the list of countries we sell arms to, and they're almost indistinguishable. We sell to both sides of many conflicts. And so it's, I mean, it's a very provocative issue. There's enough self-interest to actually have some hope of succeeding at it. And the moral issues are stark. We're a part of a really blossoming movement, both on national organizations and at the grassroots on the issue. And it's not yet, but it has the potential of being like the freeze issue of the mid-90s. So, and I think for me personally, it's simply not adequate to talk about peacemaking in the abstract. It means engagement in these kinds of issues. It means wrestling with the difficult task of choosing, you know, what is our position? What do we as Christians do? And to provide leadership for people in our organization and in our constituency, much broader, to engage these kinds of issues. With the appropriate humility of knowing that, you know, you don't ever have it all nailed down. I mean, there's always more to be learned. There's always more to be brought into the discussion and so forth. Well, that gives you an idea, I think, of just sort of once over, what lightly level anyway, of some of the issues we've worked with. There's two or three backup fact sheets or other materials on each of the issues. The hunger and militarism and nuclear issues here. The Tom Friedman article is the most inspiring poll I've read in the last 6 months. The far left pile over here. The arms trade on that chair, the curriculum project there, Hiroshima, and then finally some other LPF material. There's a few books up here that represent a little bit of what I've been sort of engaging in and thinking and reading about.
Is that the reward for coming? We get one.
You get to look at anyone you want.
Let me ask you about a specific here in the USA Today opinion thing.
Okay.
And it says, Indonesia has used American weaponry to occupy neighboring East Timor illegally. Isn't East Timor part of Indonesia? I mean, I know it's illegal. I think they did it because they were Roman Catholics. But East Timor is one of the islands of Indonesia. Isn't that right?
Well, you look it up on the map, and it is 8 times closer to Australia than to the main part of Indonesia. I mean, you know,
but
did we own?
It meant to pull away from Indonesia, so apparently at one point in time it was part of. I don't know.
The word illegal there refers to common the result of, you know, international deliberation in the UN and scholars in international law, not my interpretation of that. So,
Glenn, did you tell them about our other offerings at all?
Nope.
We're giving 1/3 of the offering in the summer to Lutheran Peace Fellowship, and the other 1/3 to a group called City Lutherans in Action, which is a group that's not too old, but is trying to enable Lutherans to do ministry better in the city. And then the other one is Christ House, which is in Washington, D.C. One of the long-term staff here, Mark Getches, his parents founded and run Christ House. It's a medical facility that is for homeless people, and so people are able to stay there. It's in Washington, D.C., and they've been in sort of a crisis of funding because Congress has cut a lot of funding. And so those are, and at the end of the summer, it will be divided up in thirds. And each week, we're having a little session on each one. And so next week will be City Lutherans in Action, and then the week after that, we'll have it on Christ House, and we'll start over again on the Peace Fellowship.
Well, I would ask to close with prayer. Dear Lord, you have called us to be peacemakers and justice seekers, to love our enemies. Give us your spirit to find in ourselves and in our community the strength and the courage to be effective peacemakers, to do the hard but necessary work of study and prayer of strategizing in action so that we may fulfill that calling. And we ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen.
Amen.